Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Giant Fork and Spoon. I'm your hostess, Chef Elena Alexander. No reservations are needed to be seated in our Word Cafe. It is here where we are serving up lots of hot topics about my favorite subject, food. Please subscribe to our channel as we continue to put more dishes on the podcast buffet. Our companion blog, giantforkandspoon.blogspot.com, is also available to view and subscribe. Our conversations here are sure to entice your palate, awaken your curiosity, titillate your intellect, and satisfy your cravings for food for thought. We will talk to foodies, chefs, culinary educators, and just about anybody who loves food. So, let's get you seated and get ready for today's Blue Plate Special.
Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock in Chicago on this rainy Sunday. I have some weather online. Let me see if I can get a little clearer signal here. All right. We're going to have a conversation today about food media, food documentaries, food represented in movies, and how those media media presence actually influence what the population thinks that we do. And somewhere along the lines, you'll find out what differences there are between what we actually do and what people think we do. So, good afternoon, big brother. How are you?
I'm well. How are you? Are you hearing me okay?
Yes, sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Well, you and I talked a little bit yesterday, and I wanted to bring that conversation to the broadcast today. One of the things that I have just recently watched was the Michael Pollan Netflix miniseries. There's 4 episodes of a series called Cooked, where he explored the ancient roots of cooking and broke down into 4 elements: fire, water, air, and earth, and how all of those things tie into his mission for more sustainable environmental kinds of things with regard to food, and how that impacts everyday life. I know you got a chance to watch the first one. What did you think?
Yes. Oh, let's see. Mixed reactions in a sense. All right. Well, let's just go straight to the meat of it. I thought it was actually a pretty good series. I thought it was pretty good, but I don't jive with the whole man became human or apes became man when they decided to use fire to cook food. I think that's a little off base for me, but I like what he was saying. I like how people feel that they are tied to the earth. They're tied to their food. Their food and reacts with them in the way that their life goes forward. I like all of that. I like how he talked about how we have a love relationship with those things that we eat and how it affects us. And I like the fact that he took a look at the Aborigines and how their lives were prior to being, quote unquote, for a better choice of words, civilized. How the white man came in and tried to civilize them and gave them religion and school and then their processed foods and how that hurt them. But then someone told them to return back to the land, and when they returned back to the land, they became healthier. I thought that was interesting. There's a whole lot to go on in there, so a whole lot that we can talk about. The whole eating meat, you know, humane or non-humane, and you know how processed meats are, and the butchering of these pigs, and how that relates to us. You know, should we be completely vegetarians? And you know, is it? But he said himself, he don't think man was meant to be a complete vegetarian. I agree with that. Meat is wonderful. Meat is absolutely wonderful. So without rambling any forward and without giving away too much, wherever you want to start, let's start, you know. So But I liked it. I liked it. I will say that.
Okay. So, okay, let's start here. Have you seen anything else that Michael Pollan has put together?
No, actually, that was my first introduction to Michael Pollan, so I had no prior knowledge of him whatsoever.
Okay. He does. He's been an author for a good long while and just kind of started doing the documentary thing in recent years. So he had, I believe, 6 or 7 books about food and nature and all of those kinds of things, same kind of theme. And he kind of reminds me of Alton Brown from the Food Network. Well, he's on Food Network now. I've seen him a long time. Alton looks at food from a scientific approach, and Michael Pollan kind of comes at it from an environmental approach, which aren't completely, you know, mutually exclusive. So I like that. As a chef, I like the elevation of thought around food to go beyond just what I think is good. I fight with my kids all the time about eating the bad things that they like to eat, all the junk food, and I'm starting to teach them to separate good for you from good tasting. They just want to say, well, it's good, it's good. And you're like, no, but it's killing you.
Right. A lot of us don't really understand what the food that we're eating is doing to us. We don't understand where it's coming from, how it's getting from where it's coming from, what process it's going through before it gets to the store, then from the store to your table. I mean, there's a lot going on that we don't know of. You know, it used to be because we're so urbanized, in a sense, people don't understand the disconnect from the land. And I like that we're disconnected from the earth. I reconnected myself in a sense because I have a backyard garden and I grow my tomatoes, my peppers, my whole, you know, I do all of that. I pickle the stuff. I make sauces, pickle it in it. I do all types of things. I'm even considering, if I can get away with it, a chicken pen so I can get chicken and I can get eggs. So, it's a total disconnect. You know, we don't know how did, you know, do you, have you ever seen a free range chicken? When it's butchered, how small it is compared to some of these butchered chickens, you know, and you're like, wow, how that is so huge. What are they sticking in that? And what is that doing to your body, you know?
Tons and tons of hormones.
Yeah, tons and tons of hormones, tons and tons of preservatives, tons and tons of things, sodium benzonite, crap that's in, I mean, stuff that's in our food, and we don't even know why it's in there.
Saline injection into meat products. You've also got a lot of antibacterial stuff and antivirals in their feed because they're so tightly packed that they frequently get sick.
Yes, they do. And he mentioned that. He mentioned about how pigs are just housed and how the sows are breeding and how they take their babies away from them and they don't get a chance to supple too much from the mama's nipple that they decide that they try suppling on each other's tails and that gets them sick. And so what they do is the farmers cut the tails off the pigs, you know, and how humane is that? You know,
not at all.
And I thought that was a very, very interesting thing. I mean, I was at work the other day and we pulled out a box of tomatoes. And I know you've heard of the Better Boy tomatoes or the Big Boy tomatoes. I think they're Better Boys or Big Boys, but they're like some of the hugest tomatoes. They're like almost the size of a small softball. And I was like, wow, what did it take to get this tomato this huge? And I told the girl, one of the ladies that I work with, I said, I grow tomatoes. I said, it's hard to get them this big. It takes a lot of natural nutrients, which you can do, but it takes a lot of natural fertilizer. But if you use a lot of unnatural fertilizer or man-made chemicals, you can get them as big as you want. I said, but these are breeded or made for a certain purpose. They're huge so you can get more out of them. I said, but you're supposedly able to take this tomato and drop it from a table height and it not split open. I said, they're bred to be tough. Right. They're bred to be tough. They're bred to resist blight. They're bred to resist diseases. And I said, but what does it take for that? Now, I grow heirloom tomatoes. They don't get, some of them, they might get that big and they may not get that big. It just depends. Now, I've grown Better Boys, which are big tomatoes, and I've grown heirloom tomatoes, and somewhere down, if you plant them in like March, April, I plant them in May, April, May, by the third picking, which will be somewhere towards August, they have crossbreeded with each other. They, you know, the bees will cross-pollinate them. I'll get bigger heirloom tomatoes, and my Better Boys will start looking like the heirlooms. That's the only way I know to do it. Now, what I'm saying is, though, you're putting this on your table every day. You're putting this in your mouth. You're eating these things that have all of this stuff that has been meant to last a minute in the last longer in the warehouse, last longer at the storage facility before it gets shipped, last longer in shipping. You know, all of this stuff that's it's just not needed. But you know, they believe so, and it's all for profit. But what is it doing to your system?
Absolutely. That's another note that I'm trying, and it's not connecting for some of my kids, but I always tell them, when you start relying on a corporation to feed you, you are in trouble, because they don't look at, is it good for you? They look at,
no.
Is it profitable? And at minimum, we may consider if it's harmful. If it's not harmful, that's one thing. But is it good for you? Those two items can be very, very far apart. So these products and these items that you're not actually meant to eat.
Yes. You're not really meant to eat them, but they just use them because it helps them on their end. I mean, because really, what's MSG? What is, you know, monosodium glutamate? What is that? Explain that to me. You know,
right.
Why is there so many different names for sugar? You know,
right.
And did you catch the part where the Aborigines were talking about sugar is what was killing them? Sugar is what was giving them diabetes. Sugar is what was giving them high blood pressure. And they said they didn't eat that stuff. Did you notice that one of the Aborigines was like 89, two of the women. One is like 89 and the other one is in her 90s or a little bit younger. And she said, we ate the sweets off the land. We ate the natural grass sweets that were out there, you know, and they didn't suffer with diabetes, didn't suffer with any of that. I mean, we it's just unheard of, you know.
Yeah,
unheard
and,
of.
And
but
the amount of sugar, you know, there are natural sugars, and there's nothing wrong with that. Fructose is fruit sugar. You know, you get honey, and those things are fine. But those things weren't there every single day. And a lot of things are not there all the time. It's to the point now that I talk to kids that have no idea what a growing season is. So they don't know. All right, so they don't know that tomatoes are a summer fruit, strawberries are early, you know, in spring, get strawberries. Okay, that's on my brother's end of the broadcast. Okay, let's see. Will this switch us back? That's better. A little bit. There's some noise on your end, brother.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sitting outside because I'm actually not at home. I'll see if I can move someplace where we don't get any wind. This is better?
Yeah, it seems like when you get quiet, there's some feedback that is in the broadcast.
Oh. Okay,
so,
I got you.
You need to have one hot platform. a lot of the people I talk to, and they don't know, like, asparagus comes out in spring. They don't know that you're not supposed to eat watermelon in December. They have no idea.
Right.
It's always available in the supermarket.
Yeah, because it's coming from other places outside of the United States. We're getting stuff from Mexico.
South America, and it all starts to taste like celery because they're picked before they're matured and like gas and forced into, you know, turning red or whatever.
Yeah, because, you know, apples are normally green. You know, apples can be ripe and they're green, completely green and not red. they don't know that some apples are dyed red, you know, and that lettuce in those containers, it's got carbon monoxide pumped into it to keep them fresh and to keep them green. So, yeah, there's so much going on.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so if there's anybody out there who's listening, if you want to ask us a question, comment, whatever, our guest call-in number is 657-383-0717. Okay, so let's mute you for a second. Let's talk about the media present overall. There's not a movie that doesn't have the, you know, especially the rom-coms, they always go out to dinner, their first date kind of scenario. There's always, you know, dinner at home. There's always some representation in almost every media thing that we do or watch or see that involves food. And a lot of times there are direct depiction of a chef, like Bradley Cooper just put out Burnt a few months ago, and it didn't go as the studio planned to be, and it probably will show up on Netflix sooner than later. But there's always been situational comedies about chefs. There's always been chef characters in different parts of the media. But, of course, they're dramatization. So not a lot of them are true representation of what it is we do. So, brother, let me hear about how you feel about how we're representing.
How we feel about our how they represent us in the media, or
yes.
I mean, how they represent us on TV?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen a TV show called Chef? It's a British TV show.
It's a black show.
Yeah.
About a black chef.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah.
A couple episodes.
Yeah, I like that.
I thought it was pretty cool.
I do think that it's an over-dramatization of us in the media. I think Gordon Ramsay is an over-exaggeration as well.
I agree.
And yes. And I say that because,
he's got like six different shows, and some of them are imported. Like he started Restaurant Nightmare on the BBC. And if you watch any of those and compare it to the American version, it seems like there's a lot of editing and a lot of things going on to make him seem like he's more aggressive than he actually is.
Yes, and that's true. I think the biggest thing that I've ran into with real chefs is they're either maybe one or two extremes. They can either be very alpha, this is how I've done it, this is how it should be done. Or they can just be really relaxed and go, you ask them something like, well, you know, hey, chef, how do you think I should do this? And they might be like, well, this is how I would do it. Let me hear what you would do. And they can be very nurturing. Or they can just be in your face. This is what you need to get done. Do it this way. Go about how to do it. I'm the alpha dog. I've experienced both of those kind of chefs. And I still think, though, that what you see on TV is just a far more over-exaggeration, because a lot of them don't want to, like, hurt your feelings. You know, a lot of them don't want to put you down. A lot of them don't. I mean, Gordon Ramsay running around screaming and hollering at people. I've never really been in the kitchen like that. I mean, never. I've never seen, because I'm going to be honest with you. I'm standing here with a 10-inch chef knife in my hand, and you think you're going to cuss me out. I don't think so. You know, or I'm like, you know, I'm just saying. I mean, I'm not a small dude. I'm like 275 pounds, and I'm about 5'6" on a good day. And I'm just saying, I'm not the one for you to be yelling and screaming at, and I don't care how much you pay me. See, so, you know, and then when you walk it in to help people, like he goes in. I've watched the Kitchen Nightmares thing, and he goes in, he helps people, and he's cussing and fussing at people, you know, and you're just like, yeah, some of this list seems so scripted, you know, and it has to be, because there has to be drama, or else people are not going to tune in for it, you know? So a lot of that is scripted, I think. I think if you want to get a good representation of a chef, watch Chef. See if you can find it. It's a BBC show, and it follows the life of a black chef from him opening up his own place at a very high-end restaurant and the people around him and their lives. And I liked it, and it was pretty good. I actually watched it, and I thought it was funny. He goes through a divorce with his wife. He's so obsessed with putting out the perfect dish. He's got a second chef or a sous chef who's very, very talented and very good. And sometimes he puts him down, though, because he's so good that he doesn't want him to exceed himself. And you see all of that, you know, and you're just like, wow, okay. That's pretty cool, you know. So I don't even know if I answered your question, but that's as close as I'm going to get right now.
You did and you didn't at the same time. Lately, I've been trying to catch up on some media representations of what the chef life is about. For example, The 100-Foot Journey was a pretty good movie. It didn't do the over-the-top kind of drama. It was about gaining a Michelin star, introducing a new cuisine to a region, and the competition between the two restaurants, that kind of thing. I really liked how that plot played out. It's Helen Mirren is one of the main characters, and I haven't seen anything that she's ever been in that was total garbage. That's just not her style. What else? Cooked by Michael Pollan. I've also watched a couple of The Mind of a Chef. That one's really good because they follow one chef around for a while and they break down how they thought about certain things and how they developed certain things. So those are really good. One of my pet peeves, though, when it comes to movies is if it's an action movie, a spy movie, even a police movie, things like that, Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker, there's always the restaurant scene where there's a chase through the kitchen, or there's the we fell into the wedding cake type of scene. And I know it's funny to some people, but it really boils my butt. I just like, oh my God, why do you think that this is okay? Because the whole time I'm sitting there like, who's going to clean this up? Are you going to replace my product? It's really, really weird to me that that exists. And I don't know about you. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think it's crazy. I'm just like, why did they fall into the cake? I mean, they weren't nowhere. Yeah, they always add a chase scene through a kitchen you see him in the Steven Seagal movies. He's got to chase somebody through the kitchen, you know, or he's a cook. You know, why is it that Steven Seagal is a badass dude and he's a cook on a cruise? He's a cook on a military ship that's being overtaken by people who are trying to get nuclear warheads. What kind of crap does that make? I mean, why couldn't he just be whatever if he had to be a cook? You know, you're just like, yeah, what is it with that? I don't understand, because, you know, I guess let's take a look at it like this, too. It's probably considered one of the lowest end things to do in life. I mean, it's like, I want to be a chef, and you go, huh? Why would you want to do that? You know, you can take out garbage for a living, too, you know, and it's kind of like, what? See, people don't, it doesn't have the passé of what it used to be. At one time, it was a badge of honor to be a chef. At one time, it was the most prestigious thing. We mentioned that before. It was the most prestigious thing you could be was a chef. I mean, Escoffier and Cream and all of these guys, and it was a man-only dominated field. Julia Chef was like one of the – Julia Childs is one of the biggest women to break into the all-male-dominated good old boy thing. You know, but it's just now, it's just like at one point, it's just the low end of what you could do. I mean, it's just
it's somebody's opinion. I don't agree that it was ever really that, but living here in Chicago, Midwest, There wasn't the same amount of reverence for a chef that you would get from a European country, let's say, or even New York. You know, their food scene has been so big for years that people understood that this is a profession. I remember when I kind of went, I want to go to chef school, I ran into that, like, all they could see was fry cook. All they could see was domestic women's work in somebody's home, you know, a housekeeper, that kind of thing. And I'm going, no, that's not what I'm talking about.
Right. But see, that's because it's such a, again, a disconnect from what it actually means to be a chef. Now, you want to talk about realism, though. Why don't they follow somebody? Why don't they do this? Why don't they make a documentary of the different ways that people take the journey? And what I mean by that is, why don't they follow the guy that starts off, he graduates high school or he drops out of high school, decides he doesn't want to go to college, walks into a kitchen, starts off as a dishwasher, and then works his way up to a five-star Michelin chef. There are people that have done that. That's Jacques Poupon is supposedly one of those guys that started off as a dishwasher, did an apprenticeship, and we know where he is now. Or why don't they talk about the kid that goes to culinary school and follow his life journey? Because there's a couple different ways to get into it, but see, people also don't understand that you just don't walk out of culinary school and you're a chef. You just don't walk out of culinary school and somebody starts calling you chef. You come out of culinary school, at least here in Atlanta, as either a certified cook or a certified pastry cook, and then you work your way up. You know, you don't immediately walk out into a five-star restaurant. You don't immediately walk out and you are first-line material. You don't know. Some people start off on the grill, and their whole thing is grilling burgers someplace. And I don't mean McDonald's. I mean, you're grilling burgers for, like, Ruth Chris or someplace like that.
Right,
you know,
right.
And it's not prestigious. You're on your feet 6 to 10 hours a day running back and forth, sweating your butt off, and absorbing grease all day long, you know.
Yeah.
Where is the realism in it, you know?
Yeah,
because what
you know,
you're seeing,
a lot of reality television isn't reality, and that kind of bugs.
No, it's not.
I don't know. And, you know, let's take the Food Network, which probably has more food-related programming than any other station. And even with that, it's always a lot of the representation are the competitions. You know, make a bridge out of cereal. You've got 2 hours to make a 7-foot wedding cake. All kinds of different things like that because they're drama filled. I don't know why it's popping like that for you. But anyway, one of the things that I like about Michael Pollan is he looks at the world of food and the connection between food and the environment and global warming and things like that. And he clearly states that the average American has so many barriers between their food and their plate. They don't understand basics. I show my kids in the class the butcher's chart of a pig or the butcher's chart of a cow, and they can't connect. And they're like, well, where's the ham? I'm like, that's his rear quarter. You mean a ham is a butt? Yes, it's that. And you heard the ham hock, and I try to, you know, break that down for them. Well, where's the bacon? Right here. And they're like, really? Yeah, this is the anatomy of what you're dealing with. This is how they're slaughtered. This is how they're raised. This is what you're eating. And they know nothing. They think chicken comes from the store. And it bugs me, but at the same time, I'm glad I'm able to provide that for them. And odd meat choices really messes up my kids. If I say, well, good rabbit is really good, and they're like, ew, chef, you can't eat that. Yeah, actually I can. Or who they're stuck on, who eats dog? That you don't eat dog, you don't eat cat. And I always tell them, if you are hungry enough, you sure certainly will. And that kind of messes with them a little bit, but teaching is a process, not a destination. So I try to get them initiated in a lot of the reality of food, the nutrition of food, not just come in and we just play and make something to eat. I want you to actually think about what it is. Go ahead.
And I believe that's a good thing because that gives them a fonder appreciation for what it is that they do. Because so many of us are, I mean, because think about it, we have been so disconnected. America is no longer the farming industry that it was. We don't live off of our farms anymore. Our farms don't raise food to support our communities like they used to. I mean, we're more urbanized, we're mechanized. We're more like, oh, okay, I'm going to go to a restaurant and I'm going to get served pulled pork barbecue. I don't understand what it takes to get there. I don't really care. I just want to eat it and I want it to taste good. And I want to go home and be able to do what I want to do. But as a cook, as a chef, you want to understand, man, where did this pig come from? How was he raised? What kind of feed was it fed? And how was it butchered? You know, was care taken into that? I mean, because if you ever read, what is it, I think called The Jungle, about the meatpacking industry of Chicago, which was the meatpacking center of America, it would make you not want to eat meat because of the way they did things, you know.
Right.
And it's just a big disconnect. And you see people who farm the land, people who farm the land and eat what they farm, people who raise cattle and raise pigs and goats and sheep and who raise the meat, they have such a different fondness and respect for what it is that they're doing and what it is that they're eating. And butchers, I mean, and cooks and chefs who are closely tied to those farmers and those butchers have a more fondness and appreciation for what it is that they do.
Absolutely, I agree. Going home to Virginia every summer, staying in my great grandmother's farmhouse, she lived with her sister, my great aunt, and there was always chickens in the yard. There was always the back field that they had past the creek. They used to rent out to farmers so they would, you know, plant a crop back there because they weren't able to maintain that by themselves. So we always had fresh eggs. I've had freshly slaughtered chicken, totally different than the chicken we get in the grocery store. Down the road, so-and-so had a farm stand, and we'd go get veggies from them. And down the up the road, you'd have so-and-so who's got pigs, so-and-so who's got cattle. My other cousin had a whole, you know, 6 acres of corn in the back. Man, there's nothing like grabbing an ear of corn straight off the stalk and just eating it raw. Nothing else.
Yeah.
So I had a bit of that coming up. And our kids don't. They really don't know anything. So especially the population of kids that I teach, they're very inner city kind of kids. And at least one of the groups that I teach, they're living in the middle of a food desert. So what they every Monday and every Tuesday, I do weekend roundup. Hey, all right, what'd you eat this weekend? And the lists are kind of shocking. Oh, I had a burger. Oh, we went and got rib tips. Oh, I had pizza. I had mac and cheese. And I'm going, do you see what this looks like? Salt, fat, starch, carbohydrate.
Yeah.
That's all you're eating. And I understand that when budgets are low, people tend to buy less, healthy choices in the grocery store. But that always seemed like it was marketing to me because no one can explain to me why a gallon of orange juice is 5 times the price of a gallon of soda.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. Or explain to me why a free-range chicken costs way more than a chicken that was housed. A free-range, you have to do less to me because it's living off the land than that chicken that is being processed. You know,
right.
Explain that one. And I don't understand that. Why does a jar of natural peanut butter that has 3 ingredients cost 10 times more or twice as much as a jar of peanut butter that has 15 ingredients in it?
Right.
You know.
And I think the peanut butter thing, I think, has a lot to do with the fact that they take the peanut oil out of the natural peanut butter and they can get such a high price to sell that oil. that they then and have started. Ooh. All right. If anybody is inclined to get into the conversation, again, the guest call-in number is 657-383-0717. Let me see. All right, now, let me see if I can get my brother back on the line. All right, so.
Yeah, can I jump in with something else real quick? Because you touched the tip of it. Now, we talked about sugar, but we got to talk about the other thing that's killing us too, and that is sodium. Sodium is a killer. Culinary school taught me that sodium is not a taste that you go for. Sodium salt is a flavor enhancer. It is used to enhance the natural flavors of whatever it is that you're doing. Herbs, fresh herbs. I grow fresh herbs in my garden. And I grow tarragon, I grow thyme, I grow lemongrass, which is not an herb, but I grow lemongrass, and I grow a lot of different herbs in my yard, and I love them. And salt, I went on a whole, we're going to do a whole salt-free thing. And it started because my mother has heart failure, all right? And the first thing I did was go to her pantry, and I was like, wow, okay, you know, my grandmother, her mother died of an enlarged heart and complications of diabetes and high blood pressure. And now my mother is in line with that, and I've got high blood pressure. I have staved off diabetes, but I got the high blood pressure. And the first thing I did with my mother was I hit her pantry. And I was like, all right, we're going to start tossing out all this processed crap. So anything that's been processed, we threw it out. So, I mean, that's, you know, processed burgers, processed dogs. I still eat hot dogs, but I try to make sure they're low-sodium hot dogs. I went into her herb kit. I went into her spices. I'm like, why do you have seasoned salt, garlic salt, onion salt? Why do you have celery salt? And if you mix all of these together, the very first ingredient in them is salt. That's your first ingredient. Then there's some salt. Then there's some, you know. So I was like, we're throwing all of this out. We're going to go with fresh herbs or fresh, recently dried herbs. And what you're going to do is learn to introduce them you learn to introduce them at two stages into your cooking. You introduce them, you split them in half, and introduce some at the very beginning, like in a tomato sauce. You introduce your herbs, like if you want to hit a little red wine on top of your onion and your garlic or your onion and your shallots or however you're doing it, you put some herbs in there and you let your herbs simmer down with that. And then you cook your sauce in. And then right 10 minutes before you're ready to serve it, you hit it with another batch of fresh herbs. But don't try any salt. And then I was like, take the salt off the table. You know, or if somebody has to salt something, leave the salt on the table. But I was like, we're going to take the salt off the table too. And we're going to go from that iodized salt to natural sea salt, or, you know, if we ever going to use salt. And that's what we do. And that's what we did. And, you know, she rejected it for a long time. And I was just like, why? She's like, I don't know. I'm just used to the taste of salt. And
that's true. I tell my kids that I teach. I say, you know, your taste buds can be trained. And you have trained it to only crave these five things. All right. One of the things that I fight with my kids about that, there's a marked difference between what my natural born kids like, taste, are used to than the kids I teach. There's a big difference. So my question for the last maybe a month or so, okay. You've got an entire backyard, got 3 acres of land, I don't care how much land it is, and I give you access to every seed known to man. How do you grow grit? They go, what? How do you grow a grit? 90% of the kids don't know that grits are made from corn. All they know is I put sugar on mine and it tastes good, or I put hot sauce and salt on mine and it tastes good. There's Facebook group that I follow a little bit called Chi-Town Foodies, and they're having that debate now. Do you salt your grits or do you put sugar on your grits? I'm like, really? I don't let the kids in my class use sea salt or any other kind of salt in preparation. I knew why I was humming like that. They do fight me about hot sauce, and I occasionally let them use sriracha, not the Tabasco or the Red Hot, because sriracha doesn't have a whole lot of vinegar and salt in it. The others have quite a bit more. And it's this constant thing of, but this is the way I like it. And I'm like, no, that's not the agreement that we're here on. Our agreement is we are going to cook these things, and you're going to taste them. If you don't like it, that's fine. However, this is an exposure exercise. This is an exposure class. You need to learn larger things about food than what you're accustomed to doing. There are lots of documentaries about food growing or Super Size Me about junk food and things of those nature. But like you said, I have never seen a documentary that actually follows the development of a single chef for more than maybe a few days or whatever. And they've already been established most of the time. They do interviews and documents about not so much well-known, but well-established chefs. Farmers markets. I can't express how important a farmers market is to the suburbs and Chicago area, because we're so very, very urbanized and city dwellers and things like that. And not many people have window boxes of herbs or, you know, tomato plants, not as much as it should be. And I think that is something that I'm going to get more involved in, is called, you know, 1 foot container gardening, that kind of thing, and make it part of my mission. Because food is not only what I really like and enjoy, but it is really a mission. It is a gospel of health. It's a ministry. So let's start the conversation about where, when, and how food is.
Where, when, and how food is what?
Shared.
Oh, shared.
Uh-huh.
You know what? I got a good one for you, and it deals with my childhood. I got a good one for you. Food is a common denominator amongst a community, and what I mean by that is, I think we talked about this yesterday. One of the things I remember is I've got some wonderful friends, Derek, Dwayne, Dirty, and their moms, TC, and their moms, and I used to love them. Because anytime I come over, it was like, Alan, are you hungry? I was like, no, ma'am. No. I was like, Alan, are you hungry? I was like, no, ma'am. He's like, Alan, you're hungry? I'm like, yeah, okay. I'm going to eat, you know, because it's like, you don't walk out of my house. I'm cooking, and I know you didn't come over here at dinner time, and you're not going to eat before you walk out this house. Well, you better sit down and eat a plate of something. You know, you better eat a plate of something. I mean, like, okay. And I mean, everybody's mom. And it wasn't, and it was like, you know, it's no wonder that I cannot maintain my weight. It was just like, hey, Alan's coming over, let's feed him. Jay's coming by, let's get him something to eat. You know, oh, Jay, mom sent you this. Oh, Jay, mom sent you some of her spaghetti. I'm like, man, I'm never going to lose weight. But, I mean, of course, I was sitting in tech school only because of sports, which is another thing that we should talk about, but we'll get to that point later. But it was a community thing. You know, you could always go somewhere and somebody's parent was feeding you. And it was a thing because they shared food with you. Now, I also want to say this too. Sometimes it could come down to they may know you all don't have a lot to eat, or that, you know, your mom and dad may not be doing well at the moment. And they want to make sure, though, that they can help you. They may not be able to help your parents, you know, pay rent or anything like that, but they could help you feed. They could help feed you. It didn't mean anything for, oh, you know, someone passed away, let's all get together and fix food and take it over to the house. or your mom is sick and we know she's the main cook, so let's all prepare some dishes and we take them over to your mom and make sure the baby's got fed. You know,
right.
We looked out for each other like that. And I mean, I could go, if I did it right, I never had to eat at home. You know, I'm not going to even lie. I could start it because I got on the schedule of, oh yeah, somebody's mom, hey, she cooks at 5, she cooks at 6, she cooks at 7. I can spend a half an hour here. I can make it to over here to eat, you know, and I was always welcome, you know, and it, always welcome. You know for a fact, you couldn't go to grandmama's house. Your mom, you couldn't go to your grandmother's, and we couldn't go to dad's mom without her trying to feed food to us.
Absolutely.
And her being, and she would be, oh, and you better eat. You better eat. And if you didn't eat, she was going to be pissed at you. She was going to be mad at you. And the only way for her to get not mad at you was you better eat something on that plate. And I'm just like, man, I'm funniest story because I got stories. Here's one for you. I was in training for football. I'm going into my senior year, and I'm weighing in at about 167 pounds. And you know how big I am, right? So 167 pounds, and I go over to my grandmama's house, and my dad takes me over there, and she's like, boy, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, huh? And she's like, Frank, something wrong with that boy. And my dad's like, what's wrong? She said, he don't look good. And my dad said, the boy's in tip-top shape. He's been lifting weights and training. He's just not eating a lot of food. And she's like, Frank, you killing my son? She's like, all right, baby, I got something for you. Mama's going to fix you a plate. So my dad said to her, which I thought was, because you don't tell your mama what to do. So he told his mom, he said, well, you can only fix him one plate. He can only eat one plate of food, and that's it. He ain't getting no second, and because he's in training. And she could hear her fussing the whole time in the kitchen. Anybody going to tell me how much food I'm going to give my baby? Boy, turn around here looking like he's about to fall out. Look, boy, look so thin. Boy, I can see his bones. And I mean, I was thin enough you could see the muscles and the veins and the arm and the whole 9 yards. So she walks out of the kitchen with a serving platter full of food. She said, okay, you said, my dad said, I said one plate. She said, it is one plate. It's just a serving platter. You can tell me what size the plate had to be, right? So she set this plate of food down in front of me. And she said, care what your daddy tells you, you eat as much of that as you want. And you just eat as much as you want. Oh, don't worry about your father. Just eat as much as you want. She walks in the back to go get me something to drink. And my father's like, boy, don't you eat all that food. It's going to make you sick. And I'm sitting there going, she had ribs. She had barbecue chicken. She had coleslaw. And she had potato salad. I had spaghetti. I had corn. I was like, how can I not eat this? My grandmother cooked this, and this woman is like barbecue queen to me, you know? And then she comes back with one of those frozen Pepsis that she just, that magically is just frozen enough that it can pour out, that you can still drink it, but it's got ice chunks in it. I was in fat boy, not so fat heaven at that moment. And I was just like, Dad's is going to be pissed at me. I'll just run an extra mile. I tried to eat as much as I could, as much as I could. I couldn't eat a lot. But needless to say, she was right, because three days later, I passed out after a workout. And when I woke up at the hospital, I was suffering from malnutrition. Go figure, you know.
Right.
So she could tell, you know, and she could tell. So, and that's just that whole of your mama's knowing. And knowing that food is what you need. And people should know, athletes, man, junk food was made for athletes. That stuff was made for them because they burn that stuff off so fast because that's what they're doing. They're just burning calories, burning carbs, and burning calories. Part of Arnold Schwarzenegger's workout when he did Pumping Iron, he ate 7 hot dogs during his workout, 7 or more hot dogs during his workout. Because it was protein and carbs that he was pumping into his system, you know. And another thing we can talk about is you talk about the farmers. They lived a long time. They lived long. They lived healthy. They were into their 80s and into their 90s because they woke up early and they tilled the land and they worked the farm and they ate everything from the farm. And stuff wasn't salted. Stuff wasn't pasteurized, processed, and salted. But they were working. What do you do now? What does the average person probably do now? get up.
They sit down.
Grab.
We don't walk around. We sit down. Most people are at a desk.
Yeah. Most people sit at a desk or sit at a job, or they're sitting in a high-stress job, sitting in an office, sitting at a desk. They're sucking down chips and pop and soda, and they're not burning that off. It's just sitting on them for hours on a day, you know, and people don't realize that, you know, okay, I'm not going to eat much. I'll just eat one meal a day. You're killing yourself. One meal a day, now your body is going to act like a camel, and it's going to store more of what you eat because you're eating so much less of it that your body goes into a starvation mode, and it's saying, okay, you're feeding me once a day. I'm going to hold on to way more than what you – I'm going to hold on to 90-95% of whatever it is you're eating. And if you're eating salt, fat, and sugar, then that's what it's holding on to, you know, and you're not going to lose the weight. Your belly's going to swell. Your ankles are going to swell. You know, you need to eat those at least three meals, no less than three. You need to eat three, but you got to at least have three meals and snacks, and healthy snacks, fruits and vegetables, you know. But I must admit, a brownie or two or a bag of chips here or there, it's not bad. You know,
no,
just moderation.
That's what I'm trying to get my kids to realize. I'm like, because they'll come at me and be like, well, Chef, do you eat these things? And I'm like, yeah, on occasion. I'm like, but I'm not eating a honey bun and a bottle, a 20-ounce of pop for breakfast. Big difference.
Oh, my God. That is, how can you, it's like we get Krispy Kreme donuts here. Have you heard of Krispy Kreme?
Of course.
Krispy
we
Kreme
had a bunch
is,
of them up here at club.
Okay, so Krispy Kreme is fried sugar, all right, and it's fried sugar, and then it's fried sugar that has absorbed oil, because if you squeeze one of the donuts, you're probably going to get a good 2 ounces of oil out of it, and then they top it with more sugar, and then they tell you for the special, you can get three of these donuts and a Pepsi, a 1 liter Pepsi. I'm like, who eats that? Who does that? You know, I don't do that. You know, and I'm just like, I eat Krispy Kreme donuts as a once-a-year treat. Once a year, I get a dozen of Krispy Kreme donuts, and as long as it takes me to get through them, 15 minutes, is it, and I'm done for the next year. You know, Pepsi. Oh my, I love Pepsi. I grew up on Pepsi. Pepsi is a staple, but Pepsi is a once-every-3-month deal for me. You know, I get a 2-liter, and we drink that 2-liter until it's done, and then I wait a couple of months. And that's it. You know, you got to learn how to do everything in moderation. And as Julia Child put it, everything in moderation, including moderation. So
yeah.
There you go. I tell you, have you tried to do the whole with my children? See, my children are probably like your children. They're very picky eaters. I mean, and it's you know, I used to make my daughter's baby food, so she ate whatever I ate. And so I used to make her baby food because I'm like, it was just a food processor, and it's not that big deal. Food processor and homemade chicken broth is all you need to make baby food. And she loved it. And I would feed her whatever I was eating. So if I was eating just Usubuco, she was sucking down Usubuco too. So she has an eclectic palate in a sense. I would love, we got to get our daughters online one day with us. But anyway.
Yeah.
Have you tried the whole let's make this junk food from scratch deal? Have you tried that? Because I do that with my kids. Every Friday night is junk food night. And if I don't order it out, I make it. So, yeah, we'll make the pizza. We'll make the pizza dough. We'll make the sauce. We'll do that. We'll make the hamburgers. I got a food grinder attachment to my KitchenAid. So, yeah, I go out. I buy the cuts of beef that I want, and I grind my own hamburger meat, and we make hamburgers. You know, fry my own chicken. You know, just it's not hard to do, but it's much better for you.
Right, but it takes more time.
Yes.
The reason why I say when I'm teaching, I allow junk food to a certain extent because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I try to, like, in a 10-week course, I try to go, okay, what do you all want to cook? And, of course, I'm going to hear all kinds of crazy, greasy things. And so... I have to temper that with, okay, we're going to do, like we do chicken and waffles. Waffles are from scratch, and it's not fried chicken, but it's an oven-baked Parmesan chicken. and we do that. Or last week was a short week. I made them make pizza. And, you know, they'll start fighting each other for the last slice, and that's all great. But I want them to understand that when we make French fries, it has 4 ingredients. When McDonald's makes French fries, it has 19 ingredients. And most of them you can't pronounce. So what are you doing to yourself? And I want them to think. Thinking is really, really hard. And the other part of that, the other side of that is getting them to follow a direction is the really, really hard part.
That's in your Yeah, following directions. I mean, come on. Let me ask you, do you follow directions real well?
Well, you know that it depends on where they're coming from. But if I hand you a recipe, I expect you to read it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, see, I do agree with that. Now, as far as recipe goes, because I'm being funny. I'm talking everyday life. Because my wife will say something, I'll be like, yeah, all right, I'm not doing it. Right. But anyway, but yes, with recipes, I totally agree that at least follow the recipe and see how it's done before you deviate from it. Now, I'm a stickler, though, when it comes to bacon and pastry. Pastry, like we discussed it before, is more of a science and more of how things react because you're putting this much baking soda in or this much baking powder or this type of lavender, you know, or you're putting this much oil and this is what the egg is going to do. So you follow the recipe because that's what – and if you follow this recipe and you follow – this is what you're going to get. But with other things, you know, you can take some leeway depending upon what it is, you know, as long as you keep some of the basics in there, then that's what it is. Because like I was trying to talk with you with somebody who was talking to me about a chutney, and I only know a chutney to be – it has to have like an acid in it. It has to have the vinegar in it. It has to have some sort of fruit in it, and then it's like a savory, a sweet, and it's got that sweet, savory, and sour and all of these things mixed into it. It's like caramelized onion with some shallots or some garlic. Hit it with a little splash of white wine or red wine. Then add some sort of vinegar to it. Then add a fruit to it. Then maybe even add a stock to it. Then maybe even add your herbs to it. Maybe your basil, maybe your thyme, maybe your tarragon. And you got a chutney. And then somebody was telling me, oh, no, man, a chutney is nothing more than, oh, God, what did he say? I put some fruit. And I put some onions together and some chicken stock, and that's a chutney. I was like,
well, I think what you're really debating is a definition, because we're both French classic trained, and in order to do that, they have a very systematic way of breaking into what you know. You do it step by step, by method, until you get going, and then you know the master sauces, even if you're not a savory chef. You know the knife cut. You know the definition. And that ties into conceptualization and understanding of what you're dealing with. So, funny aside, there's a kid that I know and going to get involved with the NAACP AXO scholarship competition, and I sit on that board. My oldest daughter competed in photography 2 years in a row, and now my middle daughter is going to compete in a couple of different categories. This will be her first year. When I met this young man, he was, you know, he's really got a mindset that he's destined to be a chef. So when we talk to him and counsel him and try to get him prepared for the culinary competition, we run into obstacles in his head as far as his knowledge of what things are. When we talk to him and his conceptualization of what is possible and what isn't, it's kind of strange. And he was once on CHOP Junior, and we try very hard to get him to understand that there's only one way to eat an elephant, and that's one bite at a time. So you plan out the system of things, and you plan out the understanding of things. And if there's something new that's being said to you, you got to look it up, and you got to define it by way of you know, what is it really? There are names for almost anything you can think of, but if you don't know how to communicate that to another chef or a diner that you're having, you're going to have problems. If you say to me, this is a tomato Florentine soup, I know that that means there's spinach in it.
Right.
But if I can't get you to understand that, then we're at an impasse of understanding.
Right. I think, too, part of it is we're getting a lot of definition. People are moving away from. Maybe that's not a good thing to say. But, I mean, yeah, you're classically French trained. I'm classically French trained. Tomato Florentine is this. Quiche Lorraine is this. Now,
right.
When you start adding other stuff to it, is it still quiche Lorraine? You know, this
not
is
really.
A chutney. If you start adding other things to it, is it still a chutney? This is
no,
blah,
it sounds like a relish.
You know? Right, it's right. It smells more like a relish. Let's get into that. But then you want to call it that, and I'm just like, oh, my God, no. It's kind of like, you know, I love with my children. I haven't really sat down and taught them. My daughter is kind of like, leave me alone. But my daughter cooks Asian, and she cooks Hispanics, and she cooks Hispanic food, Asian food, and she does real well. And she gets the recipes, but she's to the point of where she does it from as authentic as she can get it. She likes that. She likes to do things from scratch. She makes peanut butter cookies, and she goes and grinds her own peanut butter to make the cookies, you know, and she keeps it simple, you know. And it's kind of like, if this is a peanut butter cookie, then this is a peanut butter cookie. This is what it's supposed to be. You know, if they tell me that I need to add this to make this faux, then that's what it's got to be to make it faux. You know, and then, but see, people want to go, well, you know what, this tastes like that, so let's add this, and now we can still call it faux. And you're just like, the tradition says this? What?
Right. And I think it's connected to the corporatization of food, because is Taco Bell actually selling Hispanic foods? No, they're not. They're selling American food. And they're making up words. The chimichanga, that is not a word.
Yeah, where did that come from? Yes, chimichanga.
They made that up. My favorite is Häagen-Dazs ice cream. Häagen-Dazs. It looks like some kind of Swedish or Belgian name. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the oopla on it, but it's a totally fictitious made-up word. Häagen-Dazs is nothing. It's gibberish. And it's made right here in America.
And it's made it. But now here's the other thing. Now let's be realistic. A lot of it is pompousness that goes with it. A lot of it is a hosh-posh kind of, you know, passé. This is ooh. You know, and you're just like, no, dude, that's no. I know, no. You know, I think, you know, and it's kind of like chefs understand that a lot of people don't know what it is that you're doing. And that if you throw a bunch of words at them, they just, you know, if I'm doing foie gras with a risotto of lemon oil or lemon truffle, truffle oil risotto and some foie gras, and I'm going to do some herdiscote vert to go with that, and then for dessert, then I'm going to do this flan. And it sounds all great, but you just, oh, that's goose liver with some sort of fancy rice that's got dirt, that's got mushroom oil in it, and we're doing green beans, because that's all herdiscote vert is. But people go, it sounds great, because they don't know, you know, they don't really know, and you can get away with that. I mean, I'm not going to mention any names, but I'm watching a TV show with a famous chef, dude is famous, and he's cooking a pilaf and calling it a risotto, and I'm just like, no, pilaf
right.
And risotto seems. They start off the pilaf and risotto start off the same. Risotto is finished in only one way, right?
Right.
It takes 27 minutes or more to make a risotto. You have to stand over that boy. A pilaf, you can finish it either on the top of the stove or in the oven.
Absolutely.
You know, two different, total different things. But they can start off the same. They can start off with a little butter, sauteed shallots, maybe some garlic. Then you put maybe a little white wine. Put the rice in, let the rice get a little, and then you go wherever you want to go from there. But one direction is a risotto, one direction is a pilaf, and people don't know that. A lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people are getting better at being educated, though. But I wanted to talk about one thing, too, though. See, people, they like what they like. And a lot of times they like what they like because they think that's what they're supposed to like or that's what they're used to, just like you're talking about with the kids. And I make that distinction when, like, doing breakfast, you know, and you have the American omelet and you have the French omelet and the American omelet, and people love American omelets. And then it's kind of like, you know, you're cooking American omelets and they want them burned. And you're just like, excuse me? You want that smell? That, I mean, when I can smell the egg, then it's burned. Oh, no, that means it's just cooked hard. No, man, that means it's burned. You may burn your omelet, but that's what you want to eat. And I'm just like, no, that's, you know,
right.
I like that.
I have
that
a lot of that with new customers to my cake service. There's an entire population that the only thing that means cake to them is the texture that they get out of a box.
Oh.
So I've had to literally, okay, this, you know, I gave them scratch. They liked it, but they wanted something else. And I've gone back and did a second tasting with a box mix, and they're like, that's what I want. And I'm like, that's, you know, it hurts my heart, but I'm like, oh, okay, that's what you need. You know, I'm supposed to be able to provide that. But however, that's not real.
Yeah. Because that's because your body is reacting, or your taste buds have been trained to the chemicals that is in the food that are being used to, A, keep the food shelf stable, keep the food from, to keep the food stable on the shelf and from spoiling, and to keep the food to taste the way that it's supposed to taste. And because they're using chemicals to simulate the flavoring of some of these things. I mean, and if you do a cake from scratch and you do a cake from the box, man, it's a world apart. It's a world apart.
Just on texture. Cakes are a little denser. The flavors are a little bit more intense depending on, you know, which item it is. Have a lot more versatility.
Yes.
They want that plum sugar kind of thing.
Yeah, and then they can be drier, so you might have to use a simple syrup on them to keep them moist, make them a little bit moister. You know, people don't understand that. You know, it's you know what? I'm going to say something, too. You talk about the differences in overprocessed meats and unprocessed meats. Being here in Georgia, I have got the opportunity to taste deer, to have wild game. And when I first cooked wild game, I was just like, wow, this is something totally different. This is what food and meat was meant to be. Because before we added all the chemicals and all the processing to it, I cooked, I think we had deer steak that I just charboiled, you know, over a charcoal fire. And it tastes better than just about anything I ever had. You know, it was just awesome. And I had the opportunity. Now, we talk about pig, and people are always talking about how bad the processed pig is for you and how they feel bad after eating it. And I can understand that. But they're down here. I got a pig that went straight from the farm to the butcher to my grill. And I got a half a pig, and I roasted that bad boy I cooked him, slow cooked him over coals. In my smoker, and the meat, I cooked it till the meat would fall off the bone, and I ate that, and I was just like, wow, there's such a big difference. I didn't get the meat sweat, I didn't get bloated, I didn't feel, you know, sick afterwards.
Yeah, kind of hung over.
Yeah, I didn't feel any of that. I mean, I was like, this is totally awesome. So, I mean, I'm all looking for, you know, where's this butcher at so I can find these pigs? I want half a pig now that's gone straight from the farm where he was fed apples and he was allowed to eat whatever he got out of the ground. He was fed clean water and he was butchered in a process that didn't stress him out.
Yeah.
And it's such a,
I mean, let's just talk about cows. Cows are in factory farms. most of the time they're not being fed grass. That's what a cow is meant to eat. It's plain and simple. That's exactly what they were meant to eat. And the mad cow thing was so bizarre to me, because what they basically did was they, like, we buy cat chow and dog chow. There are many, many versions of that. There's lion chow, there's cow chow, there's pig chow. So they got formula of dry foods for all sorts of animals. Well, what they were doing was there's a percentage of leftover meat from when they divide and butcher a cow, and instead of having it as waste, they put that into the mix for their feed of this product. When cows are vegetarians, they mainly eat grass, and now you've got them eating cow meat from another cow, so you're forcing them into cannibalism, and then, of course, they got super sick. It's completely unimaginable, in my opinion. It's like, how in the world do you expect this is going to work right?
Yeah, that totally makes no sense. And at one point it might be urban myth, but they were using horses. They were, you know, horses. They were using horse meat to feed them, you know. And how do you turn?
There's a lot of horse meat in dog food.
Yeah, well, okay, there isn't dog food, but then again, dogs are omnivores. Actually, dogs are carnivores.
So I can
jive with that in your dog food, but not feeding your chickens, pigs, and cows. Those are not, they are herbivores. They eat just what they find on the land. And I mean, chickens might eat an occasional worm or a cricket or whatever they can get a hold of, but, you know, for the most part, I've never seen a cow kill another cow and eat it. I've never seen a chicken kill another chicken and then eat it. I've never seen a goat kill another goat and eat it. I've never seen a bunch of goats get together and say, you know what, we're taking out that other goat tonight when we're going to eat them. I've never seen that. So, no. That's greed and the corporations wanting to be greedy and wanting to get more and do less for it. And I think that is just totally horrific. You know, I'm trying to find the naturally butchered cows down here, because I'm trying to find out where these cows are at, because I'm waiting. I'm just going to try and find them, because I need a couple of burgers. I got to taste them, you know. But I like the fact that, like, Georgia's down here in Atlanta, people are moving to that. We got butcher shops, you know. In Chicago, I've heard of butcher shops, but I never saw one. Here, we've got butcher shops you can go to, and the butcher meat comes from farms. But the butcher meat here comes from farms. Farmers who raise their own meat just to send to the butcher.
Right.
You know?
We had them for a long time. And even grocery stores hired and paid real butchers. When I started working for a retail food chain up here, part of the reason why things went away as far as butchering is that it's pure economics. They did not want to pay the price of having a butcher on staff. And there was a point where every grocery store had at least one butcher and then people for packaging. Well, then they took that away for centralized butchering in a factory, and they only would send packaged meats or pre-cut meat to the butcher shop in the grocery store, and all these guys were doing was putting food out and putting a label on it or rewrapping it. And that ended on the consumer. It made me mad on the consumer. And if I go and I look at your steaks and all you got is the little skinny ones, or you only got this style or that style, but I really want a thicker T-bone, I couldn't get it because you don't have it back there. You can't cut it for me. So one of the things that I've done over the last several years is down in the meat packing district off of Lake Street in the West Loop, those companies are the main place where they send all this stuff out to stores. But there are several down there that are open to the public. So then you go into the big refrigerated room – you pick, you know, a whole entire catfish, you can say, hey, give me catfish steaks or give me this in a filet. I can ask you for a thicker cut of this, that, or the third. I can get an entire slab of ribs with the rib tip attached. I can have you do whatever it is I need you to do with my product. And most of the time, the price is lower because there's no middleman. The food that you get out of the grocery store has already been through them, and then they up the price again. And so I have no problem with going down there and getting literally, you know, 50 pounds worth of meat and processing it the way I want it to do and then put it in my deep freezer for consumption throughout the month. No problem whatsoever. Love it. But it takes me out of, I can't, that's not 2 miles from my house. That is, you know, 12 to 15 miles away from me. So I got to make that extra effort to get a high quality product, something I want for my family. You know, we don't do a whole lot of fast foods. On the health end of it, for the last couple of years, I've had the same primary care physician, and every time she does a blood draw for me, she's kind of like puzzled. She's like, well, you're overweight, and we need to get this and that and the other, and you're 45, so let's test for this and the third. And then she'll look at my cholesterol. My cholesterol last time was 167, and I have asymptomatic hypertension, which means there's no real cause. So she'll look, and my lipids are great. My cholesterol is great. My blood pressure is managed under medication. And she'll just kind of look at me with this puzzled look. I'm like, I keep telling you, I don't eat garbage.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, most of the people in your bracket, I'm like, yeah, I know. The average American at my age and my ethnicity, anytime they eat beef, it's coming out of McDonald's or Burger King. I'm like, no, that's not how I do. I cook 90% of my meals. And she's like, huh. You know, my kids get into these conversations with their classmates, and somebody say, oh, we went to Olive Garden. And my kids are like, okay. And they're like, don't you love the blah, blah, blah? And they're like, I've never been to Olive Garden. I've never been to Taco Bell. What's Steak and Shake? I've seen the commercials. I've never had it. And they're like, are you kidding me? You've never? No.
Yeah. See, for us, those are treats. My kids, those are treats.
Exactly.
But now that my kids are into the 20s and 19 and 21, and they can go out by themselves, well, they might venture out to those places. But they won't touch McDonald's. They won't touch Burger King. My daughter, she likes them. She'll eat some Taco Bell, but it's kind of like every now and then. You know, she likes Moe's, a place down here called Moe's. But we found an authentic Mexican place that serves real tacos, real burritos, and things like that.
Yeah.
So she's kind of like, you know.
Right,
but it's
and,
way
that,
out of
and
the
that's
way
the ones I'll order. Or I'll find, like, there's quite a few. Where I live now, there's a large population of Arabic and a large population of Polish. And we have quite some really good Mexican restaurants out here. But it's nothing for me to go get a falafel sandwich or a hummus plate or some shawarma. That's all out here. There's many different ways. So our primary takeout is usually either Hispanic or Chinese more than anything else. Occasionally a pizza and occasionally Arabic. But we don't do those kinds of things. So their classmates are, like, astonished. You know, we got about 10 minutes left on the broadcast. If anybody wants to call in, it's 657-383-0717. Let's bring the conversation around to the concept or the fight against what a food desert is. And in Chicago, there are quite a few. When we talk about food deserts, the definition is a little amorphous, but basically it's the concept of populations living in certain areas in an urban environment, certain neighborhoods. And if you look at the food offerings outside of restaurants in that area, it's not quality grocery store availability, a lot of the food that the people in that area are getting is either pre-processed or they're getting stuff out of what basically a liquor store that has some groceries. And that's never really a good idea. It started maybe, I think I want to say like 12 years ago, that these students did a survey and a case study that tied in food options in your local neighborhood to the rates of obesity and hypertension. And when they started looking at these urban settings, even if there were a grocery store, there's usually a smaller grocery store instead of a big chain. And those kinds of stores primarily trade on canned goods and frozen goods. And their produce section is less than 10% of the entire store. So they looked at, okay, how far does X person have to go to get a fresh carrot? And some of the answers were outrageous amount of time and effort. And if you're on a fixed income, if you're approaching your retirement and maybe you live alone, for you to get on a bus and go 12 miles to get a carrot, it's just unfathomable to a certain parts of our society. They don't see that. They don't have to encounter that. They have no idea. Uh-oh. Wow, that killed that noise. I don't know why we're getting feedback, so I apologize for anybody who's listening. But food deserts really irk me. And tied into that, farmers markets are one of the primary things to combat that. There are so many areas that you can't get the stuff, or if the stuff is there to get, a lot of our population.
Hello.
Especially the, I'm here. Can you hear me? Brother dear, are you live? Oh, okay, the call has dropped. Let me call him back in. What ends up happening a lot of times is if there are options for these people, say a Whole Food store is not too far away, or Mariano's is really cool in Chicago. But if you're on a fixed income, frequently you cannot get the option because you can't really afford it. A lot of people look at things kind of backwards. I was listening to a broadcast where the guy gives a lot of financial advice. I'm very unclear as to his exact program or his name, but he said a very profound thing. He says when it comes to spending money, not so much saving money, when it comes to spending money, frequently people do it backwards. They're willing to buy high-end clothes, high-end cars. At the same time, are willing to buy really cheap food. And it has to be the opposite, because clothing and cars depreciate. But having quality food in your system prevents you from spending a lot of money on the healthcare system on the back end. You get more out of it, out of your dollars on high quality food, than you'll ever get on a high quality car. And that to me was like, oh my God, can you say that 5 more times? You know, how often, you know, we fight that perception. How is it in Atlanta, Georgia, as far as availability? Do you have a lot of food deserts down there?
No. All right, not saying that I can truly understand what the food desert is, but what I'm very blessed, or very lucky, however you want to put it, I'll say blessed, that we have two store chains down here. One is called Kroger, one is called Publix. Now, Publix is supposed to be the high end. Kroger is the mid level. We also have Aldi's down here. Aldi's is considered the low end down here. Now, to better explain it, the hottie totty people who think they got all that, they go to Publix. The other of us, we go to Aldi. I mean, we go to Aldi's or we go to Kroger. Now, both Aldi's, Kroger, and Publix try to make their availability of good quality food. They do a lot. They both have large produce sections. They have large organic sections where everything is organic, canned organic, fresh organic. So I can get organic potatoes, tomatoes, cucumbers, onions. I can get organic. I can get all the health food. They got very large health food sections in both of these stores. So that's really good. Now, outside of that, though, we got a large DeKalb farmer market. I'm only 10 minutes away, maybe 15 minutes. just depends upon how I feel like driving that day. But 15 minutes away is 15 minutes away is one farmer's market that is very huge, that has fresh meat, fresh butchered meat, fresh seasonings, fresh herbs, fresh. They've got pastas. They make their own breads. They make their they make their own breads. They grind their own oats. They will core pineapples for you. They will squeeze cane sugar. They will squeeze canes to make cane juice for you. They'll make fresh lemonade for you. They've got a large organic. They got a decently sized organic section. You can get cheeses from around the world. Then they also have they have an organic section. So what they'll do is they'll say, okay, these are jalapenos. These are organic jalapenos from the region of. So they'll let you know these are from Mexico. These are from Spain. These are from Portugal. These are from, you know, Florida.
Okay, so
you have that.
Chicagoans are a little jealous. I just want you to know that. We got about 4 minutes left on the broadcast. There are some good farmers markets around here. I mean, Illinois is, you know, one of the major soybean and corn producers, you know, in this nation. And the smaller farms are, you know, coming out and doing a really great job. But funny enough, the ones on the in the inner city, the one in Pullman, not far from where you and I both grew up, is nice but very small. The ones out here where I'm staying now, in the suburban region, much more variety. There's one in Oaklawn that is enormous. There's 12 different farmers represented. Then we have the Amish bakers come out, and we have a guy that does, he brings all kinds of local brown eggs that are, you know, grain-fed chicken eggs, the whole nine yards. But if you go into this, to the neighborhoods who need it the most, they have the least. Again, they have the least offering. The community center in which I work has a really interesting program. They do a large farm right across the street from their buildings. They have a rooftop garden. They have winter produce, and it's in the Grand Crossing neighborhood. And their initiative is not only to produce these food for consumption, but they get teenagers involved in the whole process, planting, harvesting, and selling. So those kids get food from a whole different angle, and it's wonderful. We got 2 minutes left. Once again, you know, me and you, we can talk about food ad infinitum.
All day.
That's what we do. And the people who really don't care about food, I have no idea what they're talking about. Like, how do you not care at all? How do you not investigate at all? And that's kind of like my theme lately with my kids. What are you eating? If you can't pronounce it, is it food? If you say this is cheese and a mouse won't eat it, why are you eating it? All the time, don't you think that a cat, dog, or a mouse is less intelligent than you are? They want to
especially
say,
dogs.
What the heck?
Yeah, especially dogs. Dogs are garbage eaters. They are scavengers. And if a dog won't eat it, then something's wrong with it. I tell you why I stopped eating processed cheese. All right, real quickly, I stopped eating processed cheese because one day we were grilling burgers, and I took the packs of cheese, you know, where they're in the little cellophane. You fold them up and you take the cheese out. All right, so I left one of those cellophane-wrapped cheeses in my backyard. It gets hit in the full sun. This cheese never melted. This cheese never changed colors, and it stayed out there. I was like, let's see how long this will last. It stayed out there for about a month.
The ants are walking away from it. The ants will go right around it, won't touch it.
The ants didn't eat it. Yeah,
I love it.
So I don't eat that stuff.
Yeah, definitely. If they have to tell you it's food, if there's the word food in any of the labeling, you already know you're in trouble. Don't try to convince me it's food. It should be evident that I already know it.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, next week. Yay, there we go.